Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Tulane University's Joel Dinnerstein, whose new book is American Cool, which accompanies an exhibit at the National Portrait Gallery. We'll also hear from poet Mona Lisa Saloy, whose new collection is Second Line Home. Joel Dinnerstein is a professor of English at Tulane University, where he directs the New Orleans Center for the Gulf South, as well as the American Studies program. His most recent undertaking is an amazing show at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C., as well as his accompanying book called American Cool, the culmination of years of scholarly exploration. Joel, what a pleasure to have you on The Reading Life.
What a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Susan.
You've been thinking about the concept of cool for a very, very long time.
About 20 years. Well, I've been working on it for, I'd say, 20 years. I was thinking about it a little longer than that.
Who was the first cool person who really impressed you?
You know, it never occurred to me like that. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York in the 70s, and cool is particularly important in that period. I mean, it's important to all adolescents, but we took it very seriously. And at some point much later, I began to think, do we agree on what this means intuitively? And what would it mean to analyze it? Like, what does it mean when we say someone is cool, not something?
And were you ever thinking, how can I be cool?
Well, there was a certain intuitive sense that you wanted to be cool.
Yes.
Right? But cool can really only be conferred by others mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And so you want to think you are, but if you do think too much about whether you are, you're spending too much time on it.
Now, you break this down in many different ways as you go through the book. Mm-hmm. You talk about how it's primarily an African-American concept.
Originally.
Mm-hmm. An American concept mm-hmm. now, and a generational concept mm-hmm. as well.
Well, there are two ways to look at this. One is that in terms of the exhibit, I created a historical rubric by which we chose 100 icons to be in the book. 100 photographs, 100 icons. And so that measure has to do with artistic vision and originality and being a rebel for a given generation at a given moment and having a cultural legacy. So the people chosen have to be able to pass that particular test. Generationally, certain figures are elevated by youth culture to represent them. And often enough, it's not marketing. It's cultural phenomenon. So in the 50s, it's Elvis and James Dean and Marlon Brando. And in the 60s, it's Dylan and Muhammad Ali. And in the 80s, it's Prince and Madonna. And today, for example, it's Jon Stewart or, you know, Lady Gaga, who's not in the exhibit, but, you know, some people claim. So the question would be, do these figures have a lot in common? And if they don't, what is changing generationally that these figures, say, in the 80s are very different from the figures in the 40s and 50s who are Humphrey Bogart and, you know, Lester Young and Miles Davis out of jazz? Those are very, very different kinds of figures.
And one of the things that interested me is that it began as a musical kind of concept, and it's transcended that discipline. And so talk about a figure like George O'Keefe as an American cool figure.
To some extent, we backdated the concept. So cool comes out of jazz culture in the early 40s, and it really means to be relaxed and laid back in performance. It means that you're a person who has the situation under control and in your own style. That's what it means. And to some extent, that applies to Georgia O'Keeffe.
Absolutely.
It's the maverick figures that sort of have a personality that is both expressive and, to some sense, rebellious, right? They are in opposition to society, or at least they're not looking for social approval. And so once you have that set of meanings, we thought all the conditions for cool already existed really in the early 1900s, particularly when you get to modernism. Mm-hmm. And so we thought it would be better to expand it and go back than it would be to start like right at 1940. And so it gave us figures like Mae West and Dorothy Parker and Hemingway.
And Walt Whitman.
And Walt Whitman,
Walt
Whitman the first edition of Leaves of Grass, which he publishes on his own, he does not put his name on the title page, which is a very unusual thing for an author to do, right? He's a new poet. He doesn't put his name on the title page. He puts an image of himself on the title page. And the image is of a working man. He's in working man clothes.
Right.
He has his hat cocked at what used to be called a rakish angle. He looks both balanced, slightly arrogant, and ready for anything. And to some extent, some of my students who are not generous would say, he's saying, look how cool I am. Mm-hmm. But what he's really saying is, I can't meet you right now, but if I could, here's what I look like. And I would think you would want to meet a man like me. He always said about Leaves of Grass that I want people to read it as if they are meeting a man.
Right.
So it's a very interesting beginning for Kuhl, because what he's saying is, I'm not a great poet, or whether I am is not the point. This is expressive of who I am and what I believe. And so if I can't meet you and share that with you, at least you have my book.
Right.
So it's very interesting that he would say, chances are if you met me, you'd see this man. And that's more important to me than you associating my name with certain poetry.
And Frederick Douglass was another figure that
well,
I loved.
They're the only two 19th century figures.
Yeah.
And they represent new emergent strategies of individuality in American culture, whose, in a sense, revolution will not be taken up for another 50 to 60 years. So Whitman, for the reason I just said, also Whitman is kind of the prophet of American Bohemia. Road trips all follow from Song of the Open Road.
Absolutely.
So, you know, the Whitman one is simple. But for Douglass invents public African-American masculine dignity at a time when there isn't any. I mean, it's slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are no dignified images of African-American. And he is very concerned about his image. So all of his images have a certain fierce dignity. It's almost neoclassical. You know, it's sort of a head and shoulder shot with him looking very stern and intelligent. But it will have great effect later when jazz musicians begin to sort of refuse all the stereotypes that take place for a very long time, where African Americans are always smiling in images, in movies, in, you know, representations. And so he is the start date in many ways for what will be concern with a sort of public dignity.
Now, I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about your role as a co-curator of this exhibit with Frank Goodyear III. I mean, there's a difference between analyzing and writing a book and choosing the images. And that must have been really a fabulous, fascinating process.
That was quite a journey. So Frank Goodyear and I knew each other a little bit in graduate school at UT Austin. At the time, he was the curator of photographs at the National Portrait Gallery. And the fact, when he told me he got that job, I said, we should do an exhibit called Portraits and Kuhl. And he said, yes, we should. And I'm glad that's not the title. And so he was, in a sense, the visual culture photography guy. But we're both cultural historians. We have degrees in American studies. And so for us, it was a matter of choosing photos that both expressed a certain cool aesthetic as well as represented sort of American culture in the 20th century in many ways. So the cool aesthetic is very simple. It's relaxed intensity. What you're trying to get in these photographs is a certain kind of compelling, alluring independence. And a lot of the photos have this quality in which you see like Bob Dylan walking along Central Park and he's very intense, he's very relaxed physically, but you can tell that there is a very complex, mysterious world going on with this man. And the same is true of the photo of Madonna and the same is true of George O'Keefe.
That explains why you chose a photo of Paul Strand by Paul Strand rather than Stieglitz, for example.
Yes.
You know?
There are very few people smiling in this exhibit, in part because Kuhl is about a certain charismatic self-possession and a certain subdued charm. And you're usually not smiling and happy when you are, in effect, both looking Kuhl and acting Kuhl. That leads to the notion that Kuhl isn't all positive. As I always say, you should rather be happy and in love, which is usually about being open and vulnerable,
right,
than cool, which is usually about being sort of protective and independent and maverick. So there are very few smiles.
And sometimes, and I think this point comes across in the book, COOL seems to be a collaborative process. Like, the photographers who make these images have a lot to do with that perception.
Frank Goodyear's essay is really about the parallel rise of COOL in photography. That without the role of the image in modernity, in modern life, COOL is a much different idea. And I think that is a very important perception. So it's partly the interaction between the photographer and the subject. But COOL is actually dialogic in a larger sense. And that, I mean, between the society, between a generation and a figure, right? So it's not a matter of somebody says he's COOL and everyone agrees. It is something cultural that happens when a youthful generation sees something very new that seems to be a break with an earlier generation. And for me, the most obvious is always Elvis.
Of course.
And so if someone like John Lennon says before Elvis, there was nothing. And what he means is until then, my life was going along normally and I didn't really know or care about much. And suddenly there was a break in the fabric, right? There was a rupture in the social fabric. And now I had something to aspire to. And at that point, it's inchoate, right? It's unformed. I don't know what it is, but there it is. And to me, COOL is exactly that. It represents inchoate desire that takes embodied form. Like, here's the person, right? So, you know, Bob Dylan said about Elvis, hearing his voice for the first time was like busting out of jail. And so when I talk about this in my class or when I lecture about it, I say, so it's not our concern whether we think Elvis is COOL now or if you think Elvis is COOL now or we worry about the jumpsuit Elvis in the 70s. What we can measure as cultural historians is generational impact. And we can measure this kind of testimony. Or for James Dean and his first movie. And, you know, as soon as his first movie happened, East of Eden, packs of adolescents went to all his movies.
Right.
So that's what we can measure. Otherwise, COOL becomes just a subjective list of who do you think is COOL and who do I think is COOL.
We've been talking with Joel Dinnerstein of Tulane University, who's the co-author and co-curator of American COOL. Thank you so much, Joel.
Thank you for having me.
Mona Lisa Saloy is a poet and folklorist and professor of English at Dillard University. She's the author of a previous collection of poems called Red Beans and Ricely Yours, after the sign-off of the great Louis Armstrong. And now she's back with a new collection, Second Line Home, New Orleans Poems. Mona Lisa, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Happy to be here, and thank you for having me.
Now, Second Line Home is a collection that really runs the emotional gamut, isn't it?
I hope so. I was trying to capture how it was to come to leave unexpectedly for the first time ever, then to come back to nothing and the death and the smell of the stench and remembering all the glory of our culture and celebrating that. And then presidential poems, hurricane poems, even Isaac and Sandy.
Right.
And then a celebration of New Orleans culture. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. And it was difficult for you to write poetry after Katrina, wasn't it?
Very much so. Very much so. I think when you lose everything physically and then the disparateness of our families, we were spread 40 sheets to the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing. There was no food. There was no place to live. Downtown was just decimated. It was like the ghost towns of the Old West.
And so it took time, right? Time
yeah.
just had to pass before you could get to this.
Well, I came back and came back and came back because I had to. You were required by law to take care of certain things. We were also threatened to lose our land if we didn't do certain things by a certain amount of time. So I kept returning. There just wasn't much to return to. And then I didn't want to keep my land. So for me, it was getting a job.
Right.
So I ended up visiting several states and working out of state until I could actually return.
Now, one of the things about this collection that I love is that these are poems of great emotional clarity, but at the same time, they're filled with emotional complexity. It's a really interesting combination when you're reading them because you feel them so deeply and, you know, immediately, but the resonance is so lasting. It's a really wonderful combination. So I wonder if you'd start off and read one for us.
Well,
see you,
you
in
so
the gumbo,
much.
I think.
Okay, for the compliment. One of the reasons people return to New Orleans is our culture. We are so everywhere in everything, but we're in the present. And that's what we mean when we say la joie de vivre.
Mm-hmm.
We really enjoy life, and we tend to share it very publicly.
So true.
So what people don't realize is, okay, you lost everything. So what? What? How do you feel? What did it do to you? Well, our attitude is live in the now, and we don't worry because we have a lot of faith. And so I tried to capture our cavalier attitude about disaster and hurricanes in this poem. Especially since it's almost that time.
It is, yes.
So instead of crying the blues, we say, see you in the gumbo. And that's the title of the first poem in the book. See you in the gumbo. Soon as humidity rears its head in mid-May, we smell the rainy season coming. Got to get out the grill, smoke some coals, braise some shrimp, soak some red beans, steam that rice, and enjoy galleries. Yards, back porches, party with the DJ spinning Johnny Adams. Tell it like it is. Dance like nobody's there. Dance like nobody's there. Spring spreads aphids on roses. Something about the morning mist. A kiss to every blade of grass and iris bud. Graduations grow like mushrooms in spring. By Memorial Day, backyard barbecues rise like the sun beaming everywhere. Folks don't make no never mind about June 1st. Hurricane hype from TV weather watchers. Just count flashlights, candles in jars, canned tuna, peanut butter, water, bottle, jugged, stacked in cases. Party with family crooners and dance like nobody's there. Dance like nobody's there. Atlantic and Gulf waters stir first swirls. Daily news broadcasts brace for tropical storms turning into hurricanes. Hurry now, stock up on supplies. Storm warnings rise like cream in cafe au lait. Folks don't make no never mind about hurricane season starts. We joke about Hurricane Betsy, whose waters flowed down streets like a parade, with floating bodies of dogs, cats, people, shrimp, swollen, stinky. We party, shake off the coat of fear with a DJ spinning Joe Jones. You talk too much, you worry me to death. You talk too much, you even worry my pet. Dance like nobody's there, dance like nobody's there. Gas up the car, pack emergency lights. Shout, see you in the gumbo, see you in the gumbo. Dance like nobody's there. See you in the gumbo.
I love it when you come because you always sing. It's always so wonderful.
Thank you.
Now, the other thing, I thought it was interesting that you had included these presidential poems in this collection.
Were you waiting for the call to come be the inaugural poet? Wouldn't that have been cool?
That would have been cool.
It would have been cool.
But I'd already had the call. So when the National Constitution Center commissioned me to do poems for Presidents Bush and Clinton, when they won the Liberty Medal, and several winners of that medal had gone on to win the Nobel Peace Prize, but they were eclipsed by Al Gore that year.
Ah.
But I was brought out there, and there was a live NBC broadcast, and that's what's on my CD from Red Beans and Rice Are Yours.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted that in this collection.
Well, they're very special poems.
Thank
they really
you.
Are.
Thank you.
And they capture those moments, historical moments, so vividly.
Thank you.
Now, you can't judge a book by its cover, but sometimes you sort of can. And I love the cover of this book so much, I can hardly stand it.
Thank you.
I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the inspiration for this.
Well, my idea for the book was to capture what it was like, which, again, as you suggested, took a long time when you're grieving and you. But one of the wonderful things about our resiliency, which is what people are saying about us now, is we have a lot of heart, and this painting captures that. When I saw it, I fell in love. This is the work of Richard C. Thomas. I can only take credit for contracting him for the cover, but I fell in love with it. It was saying so much of what I was trying to capture, how much heart we have coming back, returning just to build one wall, one roof at a time, but keeping what's good about our culture, from everything public to everything personal, from worship to our cute little shotgun homes, from the way we party and second line to the way we just are together. And I just love this piece.
And the wonderful female essence of the city, what I think of anyway. Those three beautiful women and those colors, it's just amazing.
And well, I have the great Richard C. Thomas to thank for that. It's called The Mothers of New Orleans.
The Mothers of New Orleans. Yeah. Oh. And I love, too, this is my other favorite poem in this collection. I love New Orleans Neighborhood Nation, and I wonder if you'd read that for us.
Thank you. Okay, I will. New Orleans, a neighborhood nation. Possums sleep, middle of the road sometimes, invade soggy walls after hurricanes, dump heavy rains, hide in clothes closets and eat through my canvas book bags. Must taste like peanut butter and strawberry jam. The pages of wisdom spread like confetti on the floor. 10,000 spiders live in my neighborhood. What grows wild sticks like thorns. What crawls will bite you red and blue. Roaches spread wings past dusk, invade door jams. We grow, eat, love okra. There ain't no proper gravy without a little slime. Veggie slimes are us black folks on this planet. We know folks backwards and forwards translate to every little thing, nothing forgotten. Y'all is singular plural and a sweet sound in our ears. Festivals are us. Shrimp, satsumas, tomato, rice, crawfish, blues, and jazz. We throw hissy fits in a heartbeat. Fine cayenne, salt, onion, celery, parsley, and thyme on yard birds baked, fried, or stewed, even on the other white meat, anything that swims in the bayou, lake, or river. Catfish, grouper, redfish, crab, sheephead, cayenne, out of bread, whip up galette or fritters deep fried with ripe bananas or a pocket full of plantains in season, just honey to taste. When weather dips below 70 degrees, not too low, our winter's without cold when it's gumbo time. Okra, seafood, or beans de jour. Red beans, white beans, butter beans, crowder peas, plus back-eyed peas. The eyes of God on us. We still make hucklebucks in summer. Make suppers to raise bucks for folks stuck between a rock and a hard place, and pass potato salad over a fence for a backyard barbecue with hot beer and hurricane cocktails at sunset in yards or on galleries, glad for time measured in minutes.
Oh, I love that. We throw Thank hissy you. Fits in a heartbeat. That's one of my favorite lines
Thank
ever.
You.
We've been talking with Mona Lisa Saloy, whose new collection of poems is the wonderful Second Line Home. She'll be reading from her work Tuesday, April 8th at 5:30 at the Will Alexander Library at Dillard University. Thank you so much, Mona Lisa.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Sonia Sotomayor's My Beloved World, Tuesday, April 1st at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Nevada Barr signs Destroyer Angel, Tuesday, April 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tulane University's Thomas Beller is the featured reader at the 1718 Reading Series, Tuesday, April 1st at 7 at the Columns Hotel. Florida Lit kicks off National Poetry Month with poets Roger Kamenetz, Brad Richard, Melinda Palacio, and three poets from the Melanated Writers Collective, Nick Richard, Maria Sheridan, and Kelly Wallace. That's Wednesday, April 2nd at 6:30 at the Pearl Wine Company, 3700 Orleans Avenue. Alan G. Gothrow discusses and signs Italian Louisiana, History, Heritage, and Tradition, Wednesday, April 2nd at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop hosts a reading by guest poet Peter Cooley, Wednesday, April 2nd at 8 at the UNO Campus Art Gallery. The reading will be followed by a book signing and reception. Ava Augustin Rumpf signs In Liberty's Name, a novel of two revolutions and the family that survived them, Thursday, April 3rd at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop, and again Saturday, April 5th from 2 to 4 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street. Professor David Lawton of Washington University in St. Louis presents the 25th annual Josephine Gessner Ferguson Lecture on Nightingales, Voice, Pain, and Literature, Thursday, April 3rd at 6 p.m. in the Freeman Auditorium, Waldenberg Art Center, Tulane University. Everybody knows that Friday nights at the New Orleans Museum of Art are fun, but Friday, April 4th, will be really special with a celebration of Edible Book Day. Come see what creative cooks have done to turn their favorite books into treats. Judging starts at 5:30. Winners will be announced at 7. Poets Michael Gravel, Aaron Donovan, and Anne-Marie Rooney, who have all been featured at one point in the Best New Poets Annual Anthology, present a reading Friday, April 4th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Jasmine Marsalis will be on hand at Octavia Books to talk about No Cell Phone Day, the children's book written by her father, Delfeo Marsalis, Saturday, April 5th at 10 at Octavia Books. Jane Scott Hodges signs Linens for Every Room and Occasion, Saturday, April 5th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. Poets Grace Bauer, Dave Brinks, John Gary, and Julie Kane read from their work Saturday, April 5th at 2 at the Poetry Buffet at Ladder Library. April is Poetry Month, so get out there and support our local poets. The Dickens Fellowship meets Saturday, April 5th from 2 to 4 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. They'll be discussing chapters 50 to 56 of David Copperfield. Resilient Women, a performance by creative women, including today's guest, Mona Lisa Saloy, Troy Bichet, Delia Tomino Nakayama, Jenna May, and others, takes place at the U.S. Mint Saturday, April 5th at 2 p.m. Michael Patrick Welch discusses and signs New Orleans, The Underground Guide, Saturday, April 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. The 5th annual People Program Poetry Reading features an afternoon with Julie Kane, Quo Vadis Jexbro, and Gina Ferrara, Sunday, April 6th at 1 at 2440 Lakeshore Drive. Today's guest, Mona Lisa Saloy, signs Second Line Home, New Orleans Poems, Tuesday, April 8th at 5:30 at the Will Alexander Library at Dillard University. Congratulations to the winners of the Pinkley Prizes for Crime Fiction, presented at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Named in memory of the writer and community activist Diana Pinkley, the awards went to best-selling novelist Laura Lippman for her distinguished body of work, and Montana writer Gwen Florio for her debut novel, called appropriately Montana. The awards are presented by the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans. And congratulations to Sherry Fink, author of 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital, winner of the 2014 Ridenour Book Prize, named in memory of the journalist Ron Ridenour. The award will be presented April 30th at a ceremony at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.